I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Lobsang Dondup, Geshe Tsering Dondup, and Sonam Dorje. They are Tibetan monks with the Drepung Losaling Monastery in southern India, and they are here to do a number of events in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the events are many, as they are every year. There are different monks, and some of the same ones come back year after year. And one of the things that you're going to be doing is making a sand mandala at Surrett & Sons Gallery, which is next to Alpine Sports, and we'll give the times and everything at the end of the program. What is the sand mandala all about? What does it look like, and what is it?
Sand mandala is very old traditions of our practice. And it's actually literally, it is a very beautiful art, and it has a very beautiful colors of sand. So it is, the mandala actually means it's just a manifestations of our instinct powers comes into that circles. Once you were able to create this in this community, we believe that it heals this community and it heals the people who happen to look at it.
And it is a very beautiful and elaborate, it's usually a square with a circle motif in the center made of many colors of sand.
Exactly.
Each one applied precisely.
Exactly. We are not putting those colors and symbols randomly, but each and every single the symbols and colors has their own meanings, which has been mentioned in the holy text. So we have to memorize it, and we have to meditate on it, and we have to maintain a practice of compassion and wisdom while we're doing this. So it's more than just an art. So it's more as in meditations than just an art.
And then on New Year's Eve, as happens every year, there's a chanting, a meditation, a ceremony. The public is invited. Well, they're invited to the whole thing. But on New Year's Eve, then with one big sweep of the arm, you just sweep it up and take away the sand.
Yes, exactly.
Does it hurt to do that? Is it painful to see your beautiful creation swept away so quickly?
Yeah, but sometimes it looks like, you know, we destroy such beautiful things as soon as we finished. But it really, instead of being kind of, you know, upset or something emotional, we feel much stronger because it tells us lots about the natures of the life that we have to accept. And at the same time, it represents the dissolutions of our enlightened, you know, enlightened forces, powers into ourself. It starts from the center point and comes to the complete circle, and finally it dissolves back to our instinct. So that is, it represents, each and every symbol represents the path to the enlightenment. And you know, I basically have multi meanings. Each and every thing has multi meanings. So you can understand it from many different ways, the destructions of this mandala. And then here we will do the destruction, dismantling at New Year Eve. It also represents the destructions of the negativities as well. It means that when you create some positive energy by represented by destructions, seeing the natures of the life, you become more strong. At the same time, it removes some negativities. So that's how we remove the negativities of the old years and create some new energies for the new years.
Let's talk about what's going on in Tibet right now. Tibet is in a very difficult situation. You yourself escaped from Tibet when you were a boy.
Yes. So now for a couple of years, Tibetan situation has become way much worse than before. So since now, Tibetan people now become desperate, more desperate than ever. So that's why there's been a self-immolation. Now the numbers of the self-immolation comes at 94, and it just starts from 2009. And just after the very failed uprisings for in 2008 during the Olympic times, there is no positive response from the Chinese government. So now Tibetan peoples are totally upset, and it's almost become more emotional. So that's why there has been a lot of self-immolations. And we are really much hope that during the Dalai Lama's life, Chinese government, expecting Chinese government respond positively, react positively towards us. Otherwise, if they keep, ignoring, at the same time, young Tibetan peoples get more upset and desperate. And it looks like now it's a time for the Chinese government to do something. Otherwise, it will turn into something, something more terrible. Let's say like maybe more warrior things. So it's really the time for the Chinese people not to destroy the happiness, peace of both sides.
What is it that they're trying to accomplish in Tibet?
There are, in their slogans, in their most of them demands for the returns of the His Holiness and to restorations of the full cultural and religious freedoms in Tibet.
But what are the Chinese trying to accomplish?
It's just because of their greedy to occupy the land, and also to they get some lot of resources from Tibet land. So that's why they occupied the Tibet.
How did you escape? Isn't it difficult to escape from Tibet into India?
Yes, of course. So it took us almost 2 weeks to walk through the Himalayan mountains. And so there has been a lot of Tibetan peoples because of the snow, too much snow, and they walked through the snows. And many of them died on their route, and many of them has been shot by the Chinese border army.
It sounds like the border between Mexico and the United States.
Yeah, it's much worse than that, because there's a lot of snows and people dying, and there's more threatening than, because they are Chinese government and soldiers are merciless towards Tibetan peoples. They treat very bad. Once they're caught, they will torture them so badly, so unbelievably. So that's how.
I wanted to ask all of you, and maybe you can translate for us, how did each of you become monks?
So he becomes monks at 12. When he was 12, he became a monk. So at 12, he have seen a lot of monks and monastery. Maybe this is he was influenced by those communities. So what his the feelings before becoming a monk is that he would like to be so dedicated towards the Dharma, or say the philosophical studies and all those wisdom understandings. So he has such a great interest in it, so that's why he just want to live a life with that compassionate way of life, and going more deeper into the wisdoms, that way we enlighten ourselves. So that is the most beautiful things that we can ever have during our life. So that's why of course he can afford times during if he hasn't been a monk, still he can do something to learn more things about those wisdoms. But once you become a monk, you have more opportunities. It means you are so dedicated, and that way you can learn more things, and you can have more times to realize more things, to discover the reality and knowing yourself in a more perfect way. So that's how he became a monk.
And our other friend?
He became a monk at 14 years old. So I decided myself. So he would like to become a monk, because once you become a monk, you have tremendously more opportunity to learn more things, and then that is the very best way to teach others as well, to help others, because the mental peace is the most important. So that's why I can create at least some mental peace in the world.
What is your relationship as the Drepung Loseling Monastery's monks with other Tibetan communities around the world? I mean, you come here to Santa Fe once a year. Do you go to other places as well?
Of course. So we travel, we do this tour. Yeah, we travel across the United States, and we travel almost like 160 cities in the United States. And we will always meet Tibetan peoples. The purpose of this tour is to, because so once we lived the compassionate way of life, the purpose of living this kind of life is to come out to the world, to see the people, to help people, to create a mental peace, which is what we believe real happiness in this world. So that's why first purpose is to help others, to help to reach out more peoples, to provide some awareness of the reality in life and how to train our mind to be real, you know, happy. So and another purpose is also to raise awareness about Tibetan issues, and we want this rich culture survive in this world, and we believe this is also another gift for the world. So that's how we travel.
One of the things that always bothers me is that the people who most need the message of love and compassion, like human traffickers and corrupt politicians and so on, are the ones least likely to meet you.
Yes, of course. We usually meet these kind of people a lot. So we
you meet corrupt politicians and slave human traffickers?
Yeah. So we're trying to meet also, from our part, we're trying to meet as many as possible these kind of peoples in this world, so that we can at least help them to handle their mind and control their mind and to be a really compassionate one. So we have been meeting those peoples a lot, and it really works with them. So at the same time, we would like to all the human beings to get involved in the work of compassion and loving kindness.
We're talking to monks from the Drepung Loseling Monastery, and we've talked about the mandala sand painting, and there's also tomorrow, Wednesday, chanting and meditation tomorrow at 5:30 at the Upaya Zen Center at 1404 Cerro Gordo. And then there's a sacred music and dance performance. Actually, there's two of them. There's one in Santa Fe and Taos. The Santa Fe one is on Saturday, December 15th at the James A. Little Theater at 7 o'clock, and then in Taos a week later at the Taos Center for the Arts at 7 o'clock. What are these performances, sacred dance and music? What are those like?
So sacred music and sacred dance is mostly a monastic kind of performances. So this kind of sacred music and sacred performance would only be able to perform by the qualified monks. So not all the Tibetan peoples, even in the Tibetan community, they have to travel very far to see this sacred music and sacred dances, because only the qualified monks are needed to do that. So which are very, very important part of our culture and traditions. So we made this into this performance. We put all the stuffs in this show and do this performance. So here in this performance, sacred music and sacred dances, that each and every steps and moves has their own meanings to symbolize something, to remove negativities, to create more peace, like that. All of those instrument moves of the dances and chanting, singing are mainly focused on creating positive energies, creating peace in the people, removing negativities. All of them are focusing on that kind of things.
So again, the Santa Fe performance is on the Saturday, December 15th, and the Taos one is a week later. And there's also a talk, and we'll actually be speaking with Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi, who is going to be talking on December 21st here in Santa Fe about spirituality for the new world. And that'll be an interesting, but we'll be talking to him next week. And we want to mention that at all the events, including the performances and the event at Surrett & Sons, the Sand Mandala, there will be items available for sale which make great Christmas gifts and which support the 3,000 monks at the Drepung Losaling Monastery. And also there's one more event to add, which is that there is a Medicine Buddha Puja on December 23rd at the Mabel Dodge Lujan Classroom Building, which is on Murata Lane in Taos, and that's at 9:30 in the morning. For more information, you can call 505-660-3352. And I want to thank all of you for being here with us. Lobsang Dondup has been our speaker and translator. Geshe Tsering Dondup is the leader of the group of monks that's here this year. Sonam Dorje, chant master. And the three of them are from the Drepung Losaling Monastery. They're Tibetan monks who live in South India and travel the world. Now, if people want to go see the Sand Mandala in the process of creation, it is at Surrett & Sons Gallery, which is next to Alpine Sports here in Santa Fe. And every day from now through the 21st of December, you can go from 10 o'clock in the morning on, and then from 4:30 to 5 in the afternoon, there's a chanting and meditation. And that's through December 21st, and it'll pick up again on the 26th of December through New Year's Eve, when there is a sweeping away of the mandala and a ceremony. And once again, tomorrow night, they'll be at the Upaya Zen Center at 5:30 doing some chanting and meditation. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to go out with some chanting by the monks of the Drepung Losaling Monastery. And I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Kate Nelson and Margaret Bagshaw. They are here to talk about the three new books that are being put out. The first is called Pablita Velarde, In Her Own Words, by Shelby Tisdale. The second is Helen Harden, A Straight Line Curved, by Kate Nelson. And the third is Teaching My Spirit to Fly, by Margaret Bagshaw. Now, the beautiful and perhaps unique thing that's going on here is Pablita Velarde, Helen Harden, and Margaret Bagshaw are grandmother, mother, and daughter, all professional artists, all painters, and that kind of female three-generation dynasty, I think, has almost never happened. Mm-hmm. Welcome, ladies, first
Thank
of all.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So you're the youngest, and your mother was a painter, and you knew your grandmother well, and she lived to a ripe old age.
Yes.
What was it like for you growing up in this artistic family?
Crazy. It was, you know, I thought all the things that happened in our family were perfectly normal. And, you know, now that I know what you know, normal, or supposed, you know, whatever that word means, whatever. Now that I know what that is, I know that we weren't.
Right.
It was, you know, I just thought that everybody's mom was busy doing whatever they did, you know, as a career. And I would go over to my, you know, my friend's house after school to go play, and their moms would, you know, be doing sort of mom housewifey type stuff.
Because it was the 60s.
It was the 60s and 70s. And, you know, with the exception of my best friend who wrote the foreword to my book, you know, her mother was in law school. And I thought that was really bizarre, you know, because, you know, why isn't her mom finished with school yet, you know? But I thought that everybody would have artwork on their walls, because we all had artwork on our walls, whether it was my mother's or grandmother's or any of their friends or other artists. You know, we always had artwork in the house, and I would go over to my friend's house and they wouldn't have artwork on the walls. You know, it was, you know, there were some very strange things about the rest of the world that I didn't understand, and I thought that I was the norm. And so,
well, let's talk about your grandmother, Pablita Velarde, because she was a real innovator. First of all, I mean, all of you are from Santa Clara Pueblo, or that's your origin and background. And Santa Clara Pueblo women, in general, at least in her time, did not become painters.
Mm-mm, mm-mm. It was a man's job to become a painter, and it was strictly ceremonial. And so, you know, the women were, you know, we sort of have a saying that, you know, they were babies, they were baking bread and making babies, you know, and
maybe
and
pottery,
you know, and, you know, more traditional female type roles. And my grandmother was her own woman, and she was extremely rebellious. But she also had a purpose, you know, she felt that, you know, it was important to record the ways of the Pueblo. And being a student of Dorothy Dunn's at the Santa Fe Indian School in the early 30s, Dorothy Dunn encouraged her students to paint the scenes of everyday life at the Pueblo. And my grandmother probably got some sort of idea that things were starting to change, and that it was important to start recording these things. You know, following that was her stint at the WPA at Bandelier. And she was hired by the WPA to do exactly what she was taught to do by Dorothy Dunn, and that was to record Pueblo life. And that became a very important part of Bandelier National Monument.
And so she made for Bandelier a series of paintings?
Yes. My grandmother, while she was working at Bandelier, made a series of paintings. They were small paintings, not murals like they have been labeled. And I'm not sure where the title murals came from, but, you know, they were panels. They were panels that were anywhere from, you know, 36 by 40 down, depicting Pueblo scenes of, you know, maybe harvesting corn, or little itty-bitty 4x5 glass slides or glass plates that she painted, maybe recording the vegetation around the Pueblos or the animals or, you know, things like that. Or maybe wedding ceremonies. You know, maybe there were some other types of Pueblo ceremonies. I know there were some that were looked at as too sacred to be put up in the visitor center, you know, so they belong to Bandelier, but they are not visible for the public.
None of them are on display anymore because of the
fires.
Cerro Grande fire, right?
Yeah, well, no, not just the last one that we had 2 years ago, two summers ago. They finally removed all of the paintings out of there, and they're stored somewhere with the Park Service
until
right now.
The Frijoles Canyon is free of a flood threat.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, I mean, this is a... We're living in this time where it's really we're having to begin to think about the fact that natural disasters or this kind of weird human-made natural disasters that we are fostering can do away with things that we take for granted as our cultural heritage.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it's really amazing how well and how quickly they jumped on those murals when the fires started happening and stuff, and they just took everything out. It just happened like within hours, you know, and it was a really good thing. So the paintings, you know, have been shown, you know, since the 1930s and 40s, you know, up to the very recent. You know, that's a huge foundation of her career.
Now let's talk about Pablita Velarde as not only an artist who was a rebel and broke the rules and decided to become a painter and not take on the traditional female roles, but also becoming a professional artist. I mean, now maybe it's a little easier. You can maybe talk about that in a moment, but in her time, for anybody, Native American or anybody else, it was not a clear path.
Absolutely, and that was something even that Helen was facing coming in her footsteps in the 60s and 70s at a time of what I call a foment of self-actualization for women and minorities. You weren't expected to work outside of the home. You weren't expected to work full-time. And in general, in that era, I think for Native artists, it was hard to make a living. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I found eye-opening in researching Helen's life and as a corollary, Pablita's life, was they were often one car repair away from bankruptcy, even as they were achieving international fame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a very hard life back when my grandmother was starting to develop her career. There were a lot of things that were going on. Number one, you take the era. It was the early 50s. You know, it was the late 40s, early 50s. She was starting to do shows, you know, little arts and craft shows and things like that. She didn't realize that the magnitude of the WPA. She didn't know who Jackson Pollock and William de Kooning were. You know, she was just Pablita Velarde, who was doing Indian Market every year and who was peddling her paintings at the Trading Post and, you know, making enough to live on and to help support her family and her kids. She married my grandfather, who was an Anglo man, who moved her off of the Pueblo and expected her to be the all-American housewife, and because Indian women make good housewives. And he moved her to Albuquerque, and she was immediately sort of outcast because she was the wrong color. She was brown. She was a native. You know, her art did not come from the fine art school genre. It was Indian art, you know, and it was not regarded as important as, you know, maybe, you know, some of the Taos artists or, you know, some of the more educated, you know, artists in this area at that time.
So how did she handle that?
Oh, it was really difficult. It was very difficult. She kept pursuing her art, you know, and she kept doing shows. She joined women's groups like, you know, the Penn Women and speech groups where she would get up and she would give speeches and things like that, Toastmasters. And she learned how to present herself. You know, she finally was able to win over my grandfather's family, who was, you know, all Anglo, and, you know, they became great supporters of hers, and she, you know, slowly, you know, was able to integrate into the rest of the Anglo society that had existed in Albuquerque. Also, I forgot to mention, she had traveled with Ernest Thompson Seton as his nanny for his daughter Beulah. And so she traveled around the country with him while she was still very young. So she got to see a lot of, you know, the United States and sort of see what the outside world was like outside of the Rio Grande Valley, you know. And right. So that was a really good thing for her. So my grandparents' marriage came to an end about 1957. My grandfather couldn't deal with the fact that there was paint and panels and frames and all kinds of stuff all over the house.
It is kind of surprising that he didn't know what he was signing up for. I mean, this person who was an intense, rebellious painter and thinking that she would somehow just stop doing that and iron his shirts.
The nation is on the verge of going into world war.
Right.
He probably wanted to have a wife just in case.
Yeah.
And they get married and he's off to service.
Yeah.
So it was actually, I think it took Poblita and Herbert a few years to figure out, hey, we don't really like each other that much.
It wasn't going to succeed from the beginning. And my grandfather, was a very, very kind man, you know, but he was set in the way he wanted things. He was in law enforcement and, you know, he wanted a wife that would raise his children and, you know, he wanted to be the all-American family, and she didn't know what the all-American family was, you know.
So let's go on to talk for a moment about Helen Hardin. First of all, Kate Nelson, how did you come to be the one who wrote the book about Margaret's mother, another amazing painter, Helen Hardin?
Serendipitously. I do not have a background as an arts reporter. I was a politics reporter for years for the Albuquerque Tribune. I wrote a feature about Margaret and the show that she has at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, Margaret Bagshaw Breaking the Rules,
which is there now through the end of December.
Thank you. And I wrote an article about her for El Palacio magazine, the museum's magazine. She really liked the story. Unbeknownst to me at that time, the person who was to be writing Helen's story had hit a clutch point and it was not going to be able to continue working on it. And she pulled me in to her gallery. I thought I'd done something wrong. And said, had I ever considered writing a book? I said, of course I have, but I can't think of a topic interesting enough to sustain a book. And she said, I think I can help you with that. And lays
this is the
on
two
me,
of you.
Yes,
nice.
And lays on me the story of a lifetime, with a 6-month deadline, to research it and write it. And it took me a few days of wandering around saying, I don't know, should I? Yeah, I should. Should I? Should I? I don't know. And one day I was finishing up a hike and I heard clear as day in my head the words leap of faith. And that sustained me throughout the following 6 months. I would be researching one part while writing the previous part. And would start to get really nervous because the person I needed for part two was out of the country, or we hadn't found that document yet, or we hadn't been able to pin down the veracity of somebody's memory on something. And I would tell myself, leap of faith, focus on part one. And right before part two had to be written, the document would be found. The person would show up. Everything unfolded in this kind of magical way, which is, I'm told, somewhat typical with these Hardin, Velarde, Bagshaw women.
Well, let's talk about Helen Hardin. She is an artist. And you had said, Kate, when we were talking earlier about doing this show, you said something that fascinated me, which was if you took the work of the three artists, Poblita Velarde, Helen Hardin, and Margaret Bagshaw, and you put them in a huge room on the wall in chronological order. Tell us what you said.
I think, to my eyes, you would see the evolution of an artist if an artist had a 100-year creative period, which they don't.
Yeah.
And Margaret may quibble around the edges of that, but what I see is Poblita starting out in this very traditional format. Helen comes into the picture, and she's influenced by the 60s and this let it all hang out thing, Kandinsky and Picasso and modern art, and she's bringing those elements into the traditional format. Towards the end of Poblita's creative period, you kind of see her incorporating some of that modern art stuff. Margaret's raised with her mother, playing between the traditional Indian formats and modern art, and dives into the deep end of the modern art pool with her own artwork. And to me, I see a total progression among
the three
of them.
I can see it too, but you're inside it, Margaret. Do you see that?
I really have to make an effort to step outside to see. You're right. I am deep inside of it, and my world sort of exists on me not knowing what's going to happen next. You know, I just sort of, it's like Kate said, I work on a leap of faith as well. You know, I used to tell people doing my art is sort of like, you know, walking, you know, what's going to happen next? You know, I'm walking into a room with a blindfold on, and the lights are off anyway. You know, I just sort of let whatever happens happen, and I learn how to make sense out of it.
Let's go back to Helen Hardin for a moment. What were the expectations of her, and what was she like? Was she another rebel? I mean, she kind of followed in her mother's footsteps in some ways.
She was a rebel, and to Bleeda's chagrin, a rebel. The two of them had some mother-daughter issues that took a lifetime to work out. She was a physically gorgeous young woman who was plagued by self-doubt. Growing up in Albuquerque in that post-war time, that boom time, and trying to figure out who she was going to be. Dad leaves the scene pretty early, and he's the parent she gets along with. And she starts playing around at being an artist just because, for the most part, because she had this baby to feed and couldn't conform her mind to being a secretary or a waitress or any of the other careers that she probably could have followed and been very good at, except that this artistic soul was screaming inside of her. She was an incredible perfectionist. When you see her paintings, it's really best to see them in person. Prints don't tell you about the layering that's happening inside of them, but this intricate detail, and often with what looks like a spatter technique, but was in fact her point by point by point adding these paint dots to add yet another effect to them. She worked 14-hour days as a regular course of action, wasn't getting that much for her artwork, and became a bone of contention for her when she realized how much more male artists were making. And there's some particular diatribes within my book about that. When she finally starts feeling some success and giving herself a moment to relax, to say this is okay, is when a lump is found on her breast. And all that she had worked for and coming into a place where she could accept herself in a society where she's neither truly Indian, neither truly white, neither Catholic, neither traditional, but a woman on her own two feet. She has but a few years to enjoy it before she's dead of breast cancer.
So she died young, and you were still fairly young yourself, Margaret.
I was 19 years old, and she was 41.
And so had you set your direction as an artist by the time she passed away?
Oh, no way.
I was still
learning how to tie my shoes. No, it was I had no idea that I was ever going to end up in anything artistic. I was the rebellious of the rebellious. And, you know, it was really funny. Another artist friend of mine said, well, you know, why didn't you go into art from the beginning, you know? And I said, I had to be rebellious. And he said, that should have been the first sign, you know? And really, it should have been the first sign.
Rebellion is a family tradition.
It totally is. It's a precursor to being an artist. But
she, by the way, has a rebellious artist daughter now.
I do. Uh-huh,
that's
yeah.
Hilarious. Whose name is Helen.
Yes.
Very nice.
So anyway, no, I dabbled in clay work when I was young, when I was in middle school and high school, and that was sort of my creative outlet. And I was determined that I was going to become a doctor. And you know, when you look at a lot of retired doctors, they have become artists. You know, so there's always just sort of this common thing that goes through. What I had to go through to get to my artwork is I had to go through having two children, starting when I was pregnant with my second, and I had to hit bottom, and I had to realize that there was something inside of me that knew how to survive. You know, I was dirt poor. I didn't know, I had quit school when my mom died because I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't dial the phone. I couldn't, you know, I was an emotional wreck. I was married too early. You know, I got married when I was 21, had my daughter when I was 23, and I still didn't know how I was going to make a living. You know, we were, you know, barely paying bills, you know, and it just, it was just sort of, you know, hand-to-mouth type thing.
So what happened?
I started drawing, and I started entering my drawings in juried shows, blind juried shows, where nobody would know what my name was. They would put a piece of tape over the glass where the signature was, and I would enter my artwork on its own merit rather than on
daughter
who my family was. And I started selling my artwork, and all of a sudden I could pay my bills. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, how come it took me so long to get here? And I just very cautiously, you know, kept going forward with my work and developing, and I was very, you know, I was very adamant that I didn't want to have, you know, three-person shows, you know, featuring my mother and my grandmother and me. I wanted to do my own thing. I really wanted to show my own work.
Have there not been any of those three-woman shows?
There have been small ones. Like, you know, the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center did something back in the 90s. It was a very small show. And I was, you know, I did it more because my grandmother would say, so-and-so wants to have a show with me and your mom and you. You know, and it's like, you can't tell grandma no for anything, you know. It's like, that was sort of her way of saying, this is what we're going to do next month.
Yeah, right.
And so I just, you know, I would go along with things if, you know, if it was what she wanted. And, but I never really sought out to do that. And it wasn't until we opened the gallery that it became officially Margaret Bagshaw, Helen Hardin, and Poblita Velarde.
And the gallery is the Golden Dawn Gallery,
it is
the,
yeah.
Which is across the it's on Galisteo Street in Santa Fe, across the street from Collected Works Bookstore. Now, how did this three-book, beautiful, nicely bound in their own big old black sleeve three-book set come about?
Well, when my husband and I moved back from St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands back to Santa Fe, I realized that there was a lot of misinformation about my mother and my grandmother out there. My mother's painting career had really sort of gone to sleep, so to speak. My grandmother's hadn't really ever been pushed. After she died, it hadn't been pushed into any direction. It just sort of was dormant as well. And I realized that, you know, this was something that I was going to have to do. So we went on a major effort to start reviving the information, you know, that was correct. And I got out, you know, all of the boxes, you know, of archives and magazine articles. And I mean, there are thousands of articles on my mother and grandmother. And, you know, and just sort of sorting through things and, you know, sort of re-archiving. And I told my husband, I said, we need to do books. You know, and he agreed completely. And so Shelby Tisdale, who wrote my grandmother's book, she was very enthusiastic about becoming involved in the writing of my grandmother's book.
Well, and there was that Poblita Velarde show
right.
at the Museum
of
Indian
my grandmother's
Arts and Culture.
WPA career.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
which was fabulous.
And Shelby had, you know, curated that. And so we got her involved in that. And she... What we presented her with was not only my grandmother's, you know, albums and magazine articles and newspaper clippings and things like that, but also there was 100 hours of transcribed interviews that had been done by Sally Heyer with my grandmother. Sally Heyer was a scholar who was intending to write my grandmother's biography, and became ill and passed away before she could finish that. So what Shelby was able to do was she was able to use that interview process as a skeletal foundation. And so that's why it's called Poblita Velarde in her own words.
Right.
And so Shelby did the backup research, the, you know, the scientific and the scholarly support that would, you know, support the things that my grandmother was saying or it would change what my grandmother was saying if it was maybe a chronological error, which
right.
my grandmother was famous for doing. And so anyway, and we had the same archives and things like that for Kate. You know,
for the Helen Hardin.
Right, for the Helen Hardin book.
Not 100 hours of transcribed interviews, unfortunately.
No. Yeah, but there were magazine articles and photo albums and letters. The letters between my mother and grandmother, when we were living in Bogota, Kate was able to use those.
My knees got weak when she pulled that book out and showed me what was inside of it.
Yeah.
The poorly typewritten letters from about a six-month period when Helen was living with her father, who was then with the U.S. Agency for International Development in Bogota, Colombia. The treasure trove of letters of them in their own words and not expecting a public to hear them talking in them. Often in the journalist interviews, I could feel Helen's head wheels turning and editing herself, but there was no editing in these letters. I loved them.
Mm-hmm. Now, where are we now in terms of chauvinism in the art world? I mean, have we gotten past that? Are women respected as equals? And what about in the Indian art world?
Funny you should mention that. In the art world, men are still regarded as professional artists. Women are catching up very fast. It's not as big of an issue. Housewives are not regarded the only hobby artists. You know, I mean, it's so. You know, we have women who can have careers now as painters, sculptors. You know, three-dimensional artists, you know, writers, performance artists. You know, we have women who are full-time, very successful in their careers doing that. In the Native world, we have women who are potters, sculptors, weavers, painters, who are very successful in their careers and actually surpassing the Native male stereotype artist of the warrior brave, and they are blowing the art world away, but they are still not being recognized in the museum world. And you will see to every female show, there are probably 10 male shows.
Very interesting.
You know, and
curators take note.
And so that is where the Poblita Velarde Museum of Indian Women in the Arts has been born from.
Is that a project in progress?
It is. It has been a project in progress for the last 16 to 18 months. We actually have a physical facility which we open our doors in September. We're open 3 days a week, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from noon to 4. And we are in a very humble beginning, but we are taking off. So,
now, where is this Poblita Velarde Museum?
The museum is in the old Archdiocese Administrative Offices, which is two doors down from the St. Francis Cathedral on Cathedral Place.
Oh, right here in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And like I said, the hours are minimal. They were Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from noon to 4.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I bet you've had a certain amount of traffic in there.
We have had a certain amount of traffic. We also open for, you know, special events, like, you know, if somebody wants to schedule a group of people to come in, you know, we're very flexible with that.
Margaret Bagshaw is the daughter of Helen Hardin and granddaughter of Poblita Velarde. And once again, the three books are Poblita Velarde in Her Own Words by Shelby Tisdale, Helen Hardin, A Straight Line Curved by Kate Nelson, and Teaching My Spirit to Fly by Margaret Bagshaw. And Kate and Margaret will be at 2 o'clock this Sunday, the 16th of December, at the New Mexico History Museum, and you'll be reading and signing books and speaking, and the books are available there. They're also available at the Golden Dawn Gallery, which is at 201 Galisteo Street, right across the street from Collected Works Bookstore. And the show of work by Margaret Bagshaw, Breaking the Rules, is at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture until the end of December. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Sure, and just to be clear, Shelby Tisdale will be at the reading on
Sunday
as well.
Good, good, good.
Yeah.
Right, of course. Okay, great. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.